Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you ever so much to Greg for that news update. Definitely the best in the business. Greg will be back at 7 o'clock with more news. Before we get into that part of the show, let's start up with what's coming up on our show. We are taking a look at the developments from the Competition Commission around the latest fuel high food cost report that's come out. We're also going to be chatting to the National Transmission Company of South Africa on their efforts and what they would like to achieve. We've also got a conversation with BP Southern Africa around their celebration of 100 years of energy in the South African space. And then we've got a conversation as part of our first personal finance segment to take a look at how to budget and maintain your lifestyle going into retirement. But it wouldn't be our show if we didn't start things off the right way. So on this day, 1912, the Helsinki Stock Exchange saw its first transaction. Today, that stock exchange sees over £268 billion in market cap worth of companies on it. In 1931, on this day, Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, the late Archbishop Tutu, was born on this day in Klerksdorp. In 1938, on this day, Germany would require all Jewish passports to be stamped with the letter J. We know how that worked out for everybody. In 1951, on this day, Israel's third government would be formed by its first Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. In 1973, on this day, Jackie Stewart would win his third title, his third driver's title. In 1996, Rupert Murdoch would found or launch Fox News on this day. 2003 on this day, Arnold Schwarzenegger decided to become governor of California. And in 2023 on this day, two earthquakes would hit Afghanistan and kill more than 2,400 people. That's your historical facts for the day. This is the SAFM Market Update, and I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We've got a packed show, and we kick things off as always with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Makwe Masilela of Makwe Fund Managers to take a look at some of these movements, try and make sense of them, and see where we're headed this week. Good evening, Dr. Masilela. Lovely to speak to you as always. Golden Week continues in China, but seemingly markets are still trying to settle. There's a lot that markets are processing at the moment. How is the first trading week of, or second trading week of October?
You know, not looking too bad. And evening to you and to the listeners. I mean, remember, just looking at the JSE itself, you know, for the whole of last week, I mean, the JSE still managed to go up by almost 0.2%. Unfortunately, the rent weakened 1.1%. But yeah, it's all about what is happening with the inflation numbers that are expected on Thursday in the US. But when looking to the likes of the China, the Asian markets, we're expecting the Bank of Korea, the Republic Bank of New Zealand to cut rates this week, and then the Reserve Bank of India were expected to hold rates as well. But yes, markets are trying to digest all this, dialing back expectations on the aggressiveness of rate cuts, all these issues about what is happening in the Middle East, you know, not forgetting that the US elections, you know, are quickly nearing to happen anytime soon. So markets have a lot to digest, and not forgetting as well that we've got the earnings season kicking off is underway. We'll get the banks as well, and that has a potential as well, you know, to give the directions to the market. Markets have been looking for your catalyst, so those earnings that are starting this week will also be worth watching.
Marco, when we look at some of those US data points, last week Friday we got non-farms numbers come out. They came in surprising to the upside. Have markets kind of priced in a better, softer landing or a better solution for the US economy than the recessionary fears that were previously in?
You know, I think so far the recession fears are no longer there. And now people start to think that, listen, probably the momentum will continue. As you said, you know, the numbers were stronger than expected. And that itself, I guess, reassured investors who had been concerned that the economy was weakening. And yes, the data will likely shape the expectations around the size and pace of the rate cuts. And not forgetting as well that we'll be having the minutes out of the U.S. Central Bank to be published as well. So markets say, listen, the healthy U.S. job market is concerns about the economic slowdown, but also, Jimmy, blunted the prospects of another jumbo interest rate cut.
We're certainly not expecting that rate cut to be more than 25 basis points, but we'll welcome it if it is. Makwe, let's move to some local developments. I saw Sen's announcement from Richmond. They're finally getting rid of that wine app business. Is this a good time for that?
Yeah, I guess so. Remember, the guys have been looking to sell the business, and we know end of last year, the planned sale to Farfetch collapsed as Farfetch was bought by a South Korean e-commerce giant. And yes, the guys are hoping to achieve operational advantages and greater efficiency. And we know that MyTeresa is a digital platform for the operation of luxury brands such as your Dolce & Gabbana, your Gucci. So Richmond's online fashion and accessory business has been struggling, and Richmond will anyway hold 33% stake in this German e-commerce business, and the guys will also have a board, a chair, seat as well, and also an observer. And remember, the sale includes a cash of almost 555 million euros, and Richmond will also provide almost 100 million revolving credit facility.
That's a very interesting deal. As you're saying that, I'm rereading the sense as well, and it makes me wonder, I mean, to get an asset off your balance sheet like YNAP that has no debt, effectively, no financial debt at least, and to then still go and finance that business could be a very interesting approach from a Richmond that is known for its luxury. I mean, you'd think that they'd want to have a business like this internal, but this is certainly an interesting way forward. Is this something that we could potentially see other businesses look at to say, maybe some assets are not worth keeping on our balance sheet, but being a service provider of sorts still?
Remember, the business has been struggling, not doing that great. And now damaging with people who specialize, you know, when it comes to operating those kind of digital platforms. And as we said, they'll continue to have a stake. So I'm helping you that I'm also going to give you a revolving credit. And on top of that revolving credit, remember, I'll also be earning an interest as well. So it's not a grant.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, certainly. Let's move on to some other local developments. I mean, the likes of Harmony and AngloGold Ashanti both finishing the day in the red. Gold prices not really moving too much. Are those gold price pressures starting to weigh in on our gold counters or our gold miners?
I think they are. You know, remember, they're also nursing that tumble from record highs as strong U.S. job numbers fueled bears on a smaller interest rate cut. And one or the other, gold traders, they are out there looking for an excuse to try to take some profits. As we know that we were taught that things don't go up in a straight line. But hey, things can still go up in a straight line. But, you know, we just start to panic and expect some corrections here and there. So I think the minute they see gold prices going up the way they've been going up, it is kind of expected that something must give for now so that at least people can take some profit. So I think it's all at the back of what is happening with the gold price, which we know that is under pressure because we've seen the yields, especially the 10-year yields going up in the US, and that itself has been helping the US dollar as well, you know, to look kind of decent. And these things anyway, they're priced in dollars, so a stronger dollar makes it unaffordable for holders of other currencies to be able to buy the likes of the euro metal.
Marco, speaking of that stronger dollar and speaking of the developments that are playing out in the world, you touched on a couple of things at the start of our chat around some data points that are coming out this week, and we're starting to get back into that earnings season. Obviously, this is probably going to be the last round of earnings for the year, at least ahead of the US election. Are you optimistic at the moment around just how you're seeing geopolitical issues and market conditions? Understanding, of course, that things like the Middle East don't look like they're going to be de-escalating anytime soon. But is there reason for optimism within the markets at the moment still?
You know, there was, you know, but with this tension escalating, it seems that it's going to be tempering with our hopes about the improved global economic outlook. As we've seen, the data has been just decent. But yes, we've seen the German factory activity is not looking that great, showing that the paymaster when it comes to the European Union is also struggling. But Jimmy, we're hopeful because remember, these interest rate cuts, if they continue to materialize, we still have to see the benefits of that when it comes to the main economy. But now all these geopolitical tensions, I think, is starting to make people to continue to be cautious, and not forgetting that the Russia and Ukraine issues, that's still on our radar screen, and they continue to escalate almost every hour.
What does this mean for the Rand? I mean, I'm looking at the Rand's performance at the moment. It's holding its ground against the other majors. It is a bit more volatile against the US dollar, obviously, owing to some US dollar strength there as well. But are we still optimistic that the Rand is going to continue to show strength going into 2025? I mean, this year has certainly been a roller coaster of a ride.
I think most of the economic data locally have already been baked into the rent itself. The likes of load shedding no longer be there. The improvement and the efforts been made when it comes to sorting out our ports. The issue here will continue to be the US dollar will probably, if these geopolitical tensions continue to escalate, being used as a hedge against stuff like that. So that can ultimately be negative when it comes to the rent itself if people start rushing into the US dollar. But also not forgetting the stimulus that was introduced by China itself. If people get to be convinced that at least this time around the stimulus will work and we see demand for commodities going up, firming commodity prices, the rent also stands a chance to benefit, you know, in a positive way from firmer commodity prices, as we know that it's a commodity currency. So I think it's going to continue to be influenced by stuff like that.
Mark, wait, before I let you go, that commodities conversation, we've had it before in the past and we've looked at whether or not there's some merit around the Chinese demand story returning. And I'm guessing and I'm being optimistic to say that we are hopeful to see a return to a commodities, but it's unlikely we'll see that super cycle of 2021 again anytime soon, don't you think?
It is unlikely, but what we know, the Chinese government, this is the last quarter, the Chinese government, they don't want to miss their growth target. So personally, I think they'll put in the necessary efforts in this last quarter to make sure that the economy grows and to help them to be able to meet the target. And remember, the very same target for 2024 is the very same target they had for 2023, meaning they realize that it's not easy, you know, to be able to have a growth of 5%. So my opinion is that the guys will do whatever they have to do. Maybe one can say they've left it too late, you know, to come with all this bazooka stimulus. But if really it gets to hit the main economy, then definitely there might be some demand of those commodities. And we can still see commodities just doing okay, not necessarily shooting out of the lights.
That last big push into the final quarter of the year. It's going to be an interesting quarter. We've got US elections and a whole bunch of other things to contend with. But for now, we'll leave it at that. Makwe, thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Makwe Masilela, fund manager at Makwe Fund Managers, joining us to reflect on some of the market movements as well as what sentiment might be thinking.
And in your business news, Reserve Bank Governor, what's his name, has repeatedly said this and that, and policymakers are expecting rates to go up or down. With inflation somewhere between 0 and 100%, interest rate relief may come sooner or later. Who knows, really? The whatchamacallit slid into undefined territory based on the Duhigi being so-so, and the markets were hard to describe. Despite initial doubts, the outcome was a mixed bag. The Rand was meh based on the US consumer prices, but sentiment towards the currency could be, you know, whatever.
You can't base a decision on imprecision. Ask your financial advisor about a guaranteed annuity from Momentum Wealth. Personalized certainty.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Competition Commission has released the Essential Foods Monitoring Report that suggests that food prices have increased quite dramatically over the last 4 years since the pandemic, and that they're not coming down at the rate at which they had increased. Joined on the line by Principal Economist at the Competition Commission, that is Kalirendwe Ranenyeni, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Kali, thanks so much for taking the time. 50% increase in food prices in the last 4 years, even with inflation. That seems excessive.
Yes, indeed, Jimmy. Good evening to you and to your listeners. It is quite excessive. There has been a lot of increase that we've seen, particularly with inflation and the cost of the basket that the lower consumers actually buy. If you think of the minimum wage rate, that hasn't been increasing in the same rate. So what we're seeing is a lot of South Africans are actually at risk of food insecurity, because the risk or the increase, the rate at which the price of food increases is much higher than the rate at which their wages increase.
That's a very interesting point you bring up, Kali, because the wage widening or the shortfall widening for that basket has increased from 7% to 13%, which suggests exactly what you're saying, that wages now don't cover the same basket that they used to cover. They cover even less. Is that part of a bigger wage problem, or is it kind of a tandem? Part of it is to do with wages, but another part of it is the fact that food prices aren't coming down as fast.
It's actually a bigger problem, but we think that part of the problem is the fact that food prices are not coming down as fast as they should. So if you think about the baskets that the consumers are buying, so this is a basket of foods that is tracked by this Peter Marisa Economic Justice Group that sends out ladies to the different shops to see how prices are keeping up on a weekly basis. And what they are seeing is exactly that. That the rate is just, and that's why inflation is not a good measure to be talking about this thing, Jimmy. Because when you think of inflation, you are really thinking of the rate of increase, right? You're not thinking that prices are coming down. Mm. All you're saying is, if something was 1 rand, if the inflation is 4% instead of 10%, it actually increases by 4 rand instead of 10 rand. But what we want is to see the prices coming down if the costs are coming down. It shouldn't be the rate of change that we're worried about, because they settle at very high prices.
When we look at that rate in which things increase and decrease, I mean, there's been a lot of commentary saying that, for example, the increases feel like they're rocket increases, but the decreases are sort of a slow, feathered approach, and they take time and to filter through and all of that. Is this something that could potentially be standardized? I think about something like fuel prices, where we kind of have a set date. This is when it's going to go down. This is by how much. Is this something that can be explored in this space? I mean, understanding, of course, that some of the factors like droughts and that are beyond just inflation. And so it's difficult to price exactly how much to decrease by.
And I think that's really the problem, Jimmy, that there are just so many actors, right, that affect the pricing of food. So as you will note, or what we've seen in this current of the version of the report, we've seen that actually cost pressures have eased. In the last 6 months, when we spoke of food prices, we were speaking load shedding. We were speaking the strengthening, the depreciation of the rand. We were speaking, we're speaking load shedding, fuel prices, and all of that. But all of that has now eased. But we also have other problems now, like the mid-summer drought that we experienced earlier on, the winter that has just come out that has damaged a lot of potatoes and tomatoes. So the problem is that there's so many actors that I think it would be quite difficult to have a standardized approach. But what we want from food markets and competitive pricing is, when prices go down, that should filter down to the consumer. And we're not seeing that at the moment for some of the products that we track.
Mm. Kali, some of the analysts and some commentary suggests that we're not seeing that because the companies that are supposed to be reducing the prices, whether it's the retailers or the suppliers to the retailers, are kind of saying we're going to enjoy the margins a little bit more because we can now make a little bit more money. Is there something, from a legislative point of view at least, that says that it's fine to enjoy some margins, but not at the cost or at the detriment of consumers?
So part of the commission's mandate is to make sure that prices are competitively priced, or products are competitively priced. So where a market is competitive, you shouldn't have retailers and processors enjoying the margin, as you put it. Because once you're able to make excess margins, what does competition do? Whoever is your competitor will cut down the price, and that price will eventually go to where the price is supposed to be, which is equal to cost, or just slightly above cost. So we can't have a situation where, because we are not making margins, now this is an opportunity for us to enjoy some margin. Where that is akin to excessive pricing, the Competition Act is meant to deal with that scenario.
What are some of the other concerns? I mean, we touched on one very important one a little earlier around food security, because people are now no longer able to afford food. What are some of the other real concerns that the Competition Commission highlighted in the monitoring report that should be taken seriously by whether it's retailers or suppliers before the commission is forced to act?
So I think we've touched on two, and these are really the big takeaways that we've observed now. So the one is that food insecurity is real. It's now not a theoretical thing, and we can see how the rate, the two rates, minimum wages and prices, are differing, and there's this big disparity between the two. So at some point, South Africa may be faced with some social unrest, and we've seen this in other countries where the minute there's an index that is used to measure this. So once that food insecurity gets to that index, there's a lot of striking similar to what we saw the other year in South Africa as well. So that's really the one key message, that we need to be thinking of food security, and that is a real risk. The second is the issue that we just spoke about now, which is we are really concerned that market actors are not transmitting savings to consumers when they are able to. There are some that also, for example, this is really observed in different products. You'll see in the report, we speak about what is happening in maize meal, we speak about what is happening in sunflower oil, we speak about bread, brown bread and chicken. So for some of these products, and I'll give you bread, for example, brown bread, what we've observed is that the price of wheat has gone down, right? And wheat, given that wheat is a commodity, we would expect that the majority of the cost of production of bread is actually on wheat, okay? So wheat comes down, but processors actually don't bring down their price. Then we find retailers actually don't increase prices. So in that scenario, we have processors that are almost enjoying the margin, using your words, but retailers who kind of absorb that cost and continue to price where they should. But in other products, for example, like sunflower oil, that is not the case. So we are seeing differences in how processors and retailers are behaving for different products. But the message is one, right? We expect when prices, when costs go down, particularly at farm gate level, so your commodity costs, and your other costs like your rent and your fuel, we expect to see savings for consumers. And this should be the case for all products in our basket and not just some of them. So that's really the message to me.
When we look at that basket, would there be merit in, I know we said we can't really standardize a lot of things, but would there be merit in the same way we've got zero rated items that we put into a basket of essential goods? Would there be merit in saying we're going to look at a basket of essential products, and on these products there should be a maximum margin that is capped? Do some industry research around it, cap the maximum amount on these, because at the end of the day, those are the very basic products that consumers need, and then on the other margins, we expect you as a retailer, as a business, to be responsible. Is that something we could consider?
That's something that can be considered. I mean, in other countries, you find that they are price control, right? So the government says you can't price bread above this. So this is your cost, this is the margin that you should expect. But this is now an intergovernmental conversation that needs to happen. It's definitely something that can be explored.
Hopefully we explore this before food security becomes an even more serious problem, but we'll have to leave it at that. Kali, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Kali Rendwe Ranenyeni, who is the principal economist at the Competition Commission, on their essential foods monitoring report, suggesting that food is still too expensive.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next episode of Fix SA here on MoneyWeb. I'm in conversation with Ketso Gordon, who's the chief executive officer of the South African SME Fund. Among the topics of conversation, why small businesses need to be paid in 30 days, the art of blended financing, and why scalability is not necessarily important in small businesses.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's almost 6:31. You're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha, and we're taking a look at the latest company that's been formed or launched today, the National Transmission Company of South Africa. That was an announcement from Eskom. As part of that unbundling that is taking place, we have now a new entity specifically focused on the transmission efforts of our country's power supply. Joined on the line by the chair of the National Transmission Company of South Africa, Priscilla Mabelane, to take a look at this, try and understand it and see where we go from here. Good evening, Priscilla. Thanks so much for taking the time. Very interesting times indeed around the unbundling and a big milestone and a step in a direction that we've been moving in for quite some time. What is the NTCSA's mandate?
Thanks, Jimmy. Thank you for the opportunity to engage with you and your listeners. It is an exciting moment, indeed. As you know, the power reforms have commenced a couple of years ago, and we are very pleased as both Eskom and NTCSA to be celebrating this moment today. But basically what it actually implies is that we will become an independent transmission operator that will ensure competitive electricity market going forward. At the heart of that is providing reliable, stable, network connection and grid stability into the future.
Priscilla, when we look at the transmission network, there have been conversations around obviously the connectivity of that network and some challenges that have been faced by independent power producers in plugging into the existing network. These are obviously things that will be tackled by the NTCSA, but from a company perspective and from the strategic objectives that you have outlined, where does that rank on priority? We've got other priorities like 300 plus billion rands of new transmission line that needs to come online, which I'm guessing will come in through this new entity. What are the top priorities and how do we rank them at the moment?
So at this stage, the first priority for us is that we need to ensure that we have a financially viable, stable, and a business that can provide reliable operations going forward. And this is what we've been doing as a board in the last couple of months, putting the systems, the processes, and of course, leveraging some of the systems, given that we are a subsidiary of Eskom. At the same time, we also started to look at the requirements of the new mandates that requires us to provide grid non-discriminatory access. And that will actually means that we have to expand the network. So the challenges that the IPPs are experiencing is because our grid was historically developed in in the inland areas where we had our power stations. Now the new endowments of renewables are located in the Cape corridors. We need to shift significant investments into those so that you can unlock that potential. And that's our second priority that we're working on. As you mentioned, it is quite a significant investment, but we've prioritized that we will actually deliver 30 gigawatt of that in the next up to 2029. And part of that will be funded by the approved budget of the board of 112 billion for the next 5 years. And we've already started executing that. A third element of our priority is enabling an inclusive and competitive business going forward. And at the heart of that is really ensuring that we're starting to set up the right processes and capabilities to really become a market operator into the future. So we've issued the market code for comments, and we would like to finalize that as we move forward. And in terms of the second priority around grid enablement, we do recognize that this is going to be a collaboration between us and the private sector, whether it's in terms of unlocking value across the ecosystems, particularly around issues of supply chain, which are currently constrained, or it's actually seeing how we can use the private sector to augment our execution as we move forward, subject to certain boundaries around risk-sharing mechanisms that we've outlined. So those, I'll summarize, are the three key things that we are focusing now on.
Speaking of some of the boundaries, Priscilla, I want to look at the legislation. The legislation promulgates that the NTCSA would be the independent transmission system operator under the amended regulations that the minister has signed. Does that mean that there is scope for other transmission system operators, or at this stage is the NTCSA the only one?
So the legislation has actually given the mandate for the transmission and system operator to NTCSA, which will over time, as you know, will evolve and move out of ESCOM over the next 5 years. At the same time, it has also acknowledged that under certain conditions, under Section 34B, the minister is able to make a determination for other players such as that can come and develop and operate some of the transmission systems. And that's the work that today, as we articulated jointly with the minister, we are busy finalizing the regulations that will allow that, targeting early next year. And once those are out, we will then go out to on a pilot. It's very important because unlike other public-private partnerships, transmissions are very complex in nature. Although these models are tested in some of the developing markets, we need to make sure that we understand the benefits and the risks, and that pilot will be able to help us with that. The biggest part from us in terms of NTCSA is that because we'll also be operating and investing, we would like to protect our balance sheet. So we've set ourselves a clear capital structure as we move forward, and we don't want to further encumber it by providing security to the private sector.
That was going to be my final question, Priscilla, around the financial viability. You mentioned that as one of the first of the three pillars, that financial viability of NTCSA was important, but also affordable electricity still. Unbundling and creating more entities, that's not going to reduce the cost of electricity?
I think it depends on how you look at it. I mean, if you look at the role of the NTCSA, which is a global play, the more we bring generators in terms of the energy supply and traders, you'd expect that electricity will come lower and become cheaper. You've seen today, if you were there, that the levelized cost of renewables, both wind and solar, have come down substantially. And when you break down the monopoly, you're enabling the competitiveness. And that's the crux of what we stand for and what we need to deliver, is to then ensure that we can unlock that and create more and more affordable electricity so that the country can become competitive. But at the same time, the country needs to decarbonize. And by bringing more and more renewable sources into the grid, we are supporting as well to make sure that we can actually competitively trade with other global partners.
Well, we continue to support these efforts if they result in more affordable electricity for South Africans. Thank you so much, Priscilla, for that. We wish you and your team the best of luck on this new journey, and we'll certainly be keeping in touch. That's Priscilla Mabelane, who is the chair of the National Transmission Company of South Africa, that was announced today by Eskom.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This conversation is brought to you by BP Southern Africa, celebrating 100 years of reimagining energy for people and our planet. That's it. BP has celebrated a century of operations in South Africa, or Southern Africa rather, and it's a milestone that we're certainly going to commemorate with them. I'm joined on the line by the Executive for Communications and External Affairs at BP Southern Africa. That's Hamlet Morule, to take a look at this and try and see where to from here. Good evening, Hamlet. Thanks so much for taking the time. A century is no small feat. Take us through the journey and the history that is the BP's relationship with Southern Africa and South Africa.
Good evening to you, Jimmy, and good evening to the listeners. Indeed, this is a very, very important milestone for BP. On the 9th of May this year, we marked a full 100 years being operational within Southern Africa. Most of the people who know BP well would associate BP with quite a number of things. One of those being, you know, the long support that BP has had for BP Top 8, but I'll come to that later. BP was set up in 1924, as I indicated. Very, very small operation at that at that particular time, because of course there were lesser cars at that point in time. Ford had just established its operations in South Africa as well around that particular time. It's been a very, very long journey that has really transitioned from that original garage that we all knew to what we see today, you know, a very, very operational establishment that includes quite a number of things, very, very importantly being the convenience aspect that is embedded within our service stations these days. So it has indeed been a long journey. We're celebrating it throughout the year. In fact, in 2 days' time, we will be convening an event, you know, to recognize those who have been with us throughout this journey at the Sandton Convention Center. The event is on Wednesday.
Hamlet, when people think about BP, a lot of people make the mistake of saying BP is just an oil company or just a fuel company. All they do is filling stations. But in reality, BP's always been very clear that you're an energy company. What does that mean?
What it primarily means, Jimmy, is a few things, but I'll start with one particular aspect. Yes, we have been traditionally being an oil and gas company. We are busy transitioning as it is from an oil company to an energy company, you know, an integrated energy company. And that is driven by a number of factors. One factor that is very, very important is that we are looking at a lower carbon future. With a lower carbon future, we cannot continue only being a gas and oil company. But as BP, we are not abandoning that particular aspect, but we are transitioning to ensure that there is a very good balance between, you know, an energy system in South Africa or globally, you know, that provides secure, affordable, and lower carbon.
I certainly remember a time where we started this decarbonization conversation, and BP, I think it was BP Europe, came out very clearly to say we're going to be one of the first energy companies to transition and go for a cleaner conversation as part of what we do in our operations. Hamlet, looking at some of the South African operations, there have been a couple of announcements recently, the likes of the SAPREF sale to the Central Energy Fund, where you disinvested from SAPREF, selling off your East London terminal as well to the WASSA. When people kind of see these announcements, a lot of the announcements look as though BP might be disinvesting from South Africa or planning to exit South Africa. Is that the case, or is the business saying we're doing things differently?
You know, as a business, we remain in South Africa and we are here to stay, Jimmy. You know, we are using actually this moment of, you know, celebration to reinforce our message that says that BP is here to stay in South Africa. Yes, indeed, there has been changes in terms of how we do business in South Africa. And I'll take the examples that you've used. While BPSA has divested from or moved away from certain operations, because I think I need to choose my words carefully, because with most of these, it was not necessarily divesting. Let's take Masana Energy for an example. As we were moving from other operations and changing how we operate locally, we thought it necessary that simultaneously we needed to actually sort of reinvent ourselves. Masana Energy Solutions, for an example, is an operating joint venture with BP. It was created in 2005, and it's got empowerment partners. You know, when it started then, the Mine Workers Investment Company, Women's Development Bank Holdings, this was one of the first initiatives that we took at BP. Other similar transactions, as we indicated, is the recent sale of the East London terminal to ASA. If you do not have intrinsic knowledge of the difficulty that some of the companies have, particularly with infrastructure, you would not understand the importance of such transactions. But these are very, very important transactions that enable locally business companies to be able to actually run their companies efficiently, because infrastructure is key in the area of business that we are in. There are others, but I think let me leave it with those two as examples.
Sometimes it's just a strategic decision, and there's nothing wrong with that. Hamlet, let's look at the fact that you're celebrating this milestone in the month of October, and it's quite serendipitous that the month of October also happens to be Transport Awareness Month, and you guys kind of fit right into that entire ecosystem. Take me through just the importance of the transport sector, not only for a business like yours, but for an economy like South Africa's, to ensure the South Africa's economy keeps moving.
Yes, indeed, Jimmy. In fact, one of the last things you said was that these are sometimes strategic decisions. I would say that in all instances, these are actually strategic decisions that we do take as PP. Indeed, according to NATIS, the National Traffic Information System, there are currently more than 12 million motor vehicles, within our roads in South Africa. And, you know, with that kind of traffic that we've got in South Africa, this naturally, of course, creates fuel demand from motorists, which of course then propels the way we do business in South Africa and the way we respond to the business in South Africa. The transport sector itself, if you look at it, it accounts for about 60% of total oil demand. This is very, very key to the business that we manage, that we run within South Africa. So it is indeed important that, events like these where we recognize how long we've been in South Africa are done during this very, very important month of Transport Month.
Hamlet, when people kind of look at these sorts of celebrations and you look at the milestones and you look at all that businesses like BP have achieved over the last 100 years, some of the things that people often forget is the fact that for a company to be around for 100 years in South Africa, you have to be part of the community. You have to be involved in the community. And the BP South Africa has been very, very clear around its community initiatives and uplifting the communities around it. Take us through just some of how those initiatives have evolved over the last, say, 100 years, and what that then means for BP going into the next 100.
Yeah, well, As it's often said, but when we say it, we really mean it, Jimmy. Investing within our host communities is within the DNA of how we do business. Earlier on, I did mention that people like me and you definitely remember the BP Top 8, something that was known, a partnership that was known for many, many years within the South African sports fraternity. BP continues to do that. It continues to invest in very, very strategic areas. I'll give you an example of a very recent partnership that we launched with the Small Enterprise Finance Agency, usually called SEFA. It's a win-win type of an arrangement that we've had with SEFA. We need to continue transforming the ownership patterns in South Africa in line with the BBBEE legislation and the transformation agenda within South Africa. So we partnered with SEPA, and this partnership created a fund that is utilized by dealers who are new within this business, or dealers who would like to expand their ownership of service stations. I did indicate earlier that we are here to stay. So we are looking at pockets of land. We are looking at strategic areas within the freeways in South Africa and so on, where we can deliver new projects. And it is within that context that we try to look at new ownership arrangements so that, we improve our overall ownership, percentages which are black.
Well, here's
we have a partnership currently, or maybe, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all right. You can wrap that up, Hamlet.
Oh, I was about to say that The second one that is very, very key to us that we are busy with, it's a partnership that we have with the Energy Mobility Education Fast. So EMET, as we usually just call it, also has an equity within BPSA, 5% stake within BPSA. But, you know, very, very importantly, it is an implementing partner for BPSA for programs with a number of very, very known universities in South Africa. We have about six, universities that we are supporting through EMET. And in the last 10 years, because they were established 10 years ago as well, we've spent in excess of 240 million through bursaries, through programs that we're doing with high schools. And that's not really a very, very low investment. We continue with these programs, and EMET is busy actually expanding some of these programs so that we reach others who are doing postgraduate studies and so forth.
Well, here's to another 100 years of BP in South Africa and all the work that you continue to do. I think we'll leave it at that, Hamlet. Thanks for the time and for the insights. We celebrate with you and continue to hope for the best for the business. That's Hamlet Morulu, who is the Executive for Communications and External Affairs at BP South Africa. This conversation was brought to you by BP Southern Africa, marking 100 years of reimagining energy for people and our planet.
So how's my life been? Literally the best. With BP, it's been reward after reward. And like, can you even believe it? I get up to 30 cents per litre back when I swipe my new BP rewards and smart shopper cards for fuel. But wait, there's more. I also get 1% cash back on all my munchies at BP Express. I've been saving, like saving. It's giving ka-ching. BP, every day brighter.
It's a Monday. It's the first Monday of October, which means it's the first personal finance segment that we have for this month. And this week, we are taking a look at budgeting within retirement, how to make sure that the retirement funds you have last you as long as possible. I'm joined on the line by the founder and CEO at Family Wealth Custodians, Hardy Swart, to take a look at this, try and make sense of it, and see if we can understand it. Good evening, Hardy. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by looking at the importance of having a very clear and concise plan after retirement. I mean, it's all good and well to have one before you retire. You speak to your financial planner around that. But once you have retired and suddenly you have all of this free time and all of this ability to spend the money you've worked hard for throughout the years, where do you start with the budgeting process?
Ah, good day, Jimmy. Oh, thanks. So it's such an important question. So I think the most important thing is when you start with budgeting is to form a base. And normally when I sit and engage with clients, I recommend that we start with your medical expenses as the base. You know, if you've got a medical insurance or a medical aid, start with that because that normally increases slightly higher than your normal inflation. So we start that as a base, and we know that that's part of the sort of retirement budgeting process. Next, we'll look at what is your basic living expenses. So rates and taxes, your electricity, your water, that sort of thing, and put that into your budget to make sure that you've got that covered. Because in the end of the day, that's the most important thing. We need to ensure that we've got our medical expenses covered and that we've got a roof over our head and that we can at least have water and electricity. And then once you've got that, in Family Wealth, we talk about what we call the go-go years. So that's normally the first sort of 10 to 15 years after retirement when people normally have a bit more time to travel and enjoy the finer side of finer things in life. And you might need to budget a bit more for that, you know, if you want to go eat out occasionally or travel a bit. And then we need to build that into your budget and also taking things into consideration like capital expenses, like if you need to replace your car every couple of years and that sort of thing.
How do these all sound like very important decisions to be considering, and we'll get to just how you plan around some of those in a second. I want to start by looking at the conversation around how much to withdraw, because that will then speak to what we then spend the money on and all of those things. There's something called a replacement ratio. There's a kind of a set amount or a guide as to how much you should be accessing per year. Why is that amount what it is, and how is it worked out?
So first of all, it's unique for every single person. So what might work for one person is not necessarily going to work for someone else. So in the industry, a common phrase you'll hear very often is they talk about the 4% rule, saying that you shouldn't withdraw more than 4% of your invested capital, because with inflation and market growth, if you withdraw more than 4%, you might run out of capital before you eventually pass away. But again, Jamie, that's not set in stone. It really depends on your unique situation and what your needs are. And then, of course, there's a lot of factors that we can't control. I mean, we don't have a crystal ball and know what the markets are going to do into the future. But in principle, the idea is that, you know, if inflation sits at around about 6% and you withdrawing approximately 4%, then you want your capital to grow at about 10%, which is the net replacement ratio, so that your capital keeps up with inflation. And effectively, you're only living off the returns of your investment and you're keeping up with inflation. So that's in core the concept that that investors would look at. But what we found over the years that it's very, very difficult for many investors to only withdraw 4%. And many investors err more towards 6 or 7%, which is sometimes too high. But that's why it's so important to sit with someone that can walk through your budget, walk through the different sort of return profiles and risks that you need to take into consideration, and to build a plan that's unique to your specific needs.
Hardly, 6 or 7% seems a bit higher than what we'd like it to be. Does this kind of stem from people having additional expenses going into retirement? And if that is the case, is it then ideal to say, as much as possible before I retire, pay off as much of my debt as possible so that in retirement I'm living off of less?
That's the ideal situation. If it is possible to pay off all your debts before you retire, that would be your first priority. Unfortunately, we do find that some retirees aren't able to do that, and they do enter retirement with some sort of debt. I think the big problem is that a lot of us, if we want to build a house, we've got a very detailed plan to build a house. But not a lot of people have a detailed plan when it comes to their finances, and especially their retirement finances. So people sort of contribute to their retirement savings or their pension fund, but they don't really know what they're going to need one day. And I think that's so important, is just to sit with someone to help you determine what are your needs, how much are you really going to need when you get to retirement to maintain your standard of living. And yeah, so that's I think would be the basis, just to and the reason why a lot of people, why their capital don't last is, there's various reasons. One might be they're not keeping up with inflation. Another one might be that they invested in something that didn't give them the sort of returns that they hoped for. So there are a lot of different reasons why people don't necessarily aren't able to sort of keep on withdrawing the same amount that they would like to.
Hardy, we can't have this conversation without looking at tax. There's always going to be tax implications. There's no getting around it. There's no point trying to avoid it. It is there. But there's also the efficiency side of it. I mean, there's lump sums you can access that are tax exempt. There's tax benefits of having certain types of products. I think about endowment products and all of that. How do you approach the tax side of it going into retirement, understanding that you can access some of your money in a tax efficient manner without putting yourself in a difficult position?
No, that's so true. So when you get to retirement, and for instance, you're retiring from your pension fund, a company pension fund, and that's the first time you're making a withdrawal from your company pension fund, then you are able to withdraw 1/3 of the portfolio as a lump sum. And from that lump sum, about 550,000 rand of that will be taxed at zero rate. So there's no tax on the first 550,000 rand. So that is one benefit, and you can then invest that 550,000 rand in a sort of an investment plan or something, then and withdraw an income from that. But the amount that you then transfer from your pension fund into an annuity, which could either be a life annuity or a living annuity, and there's different rules for both, that amount, then you're going to start earning an income from that.
And we'll have to leave that conversation there because it is 7 o'clock. Greg Hose is standing by for the latest round of evening news. But thank you so much to Hardy Swart, who's director at Family Wealth Custodians, for that. As I said, Greg standing by for the latest round of evening news, followed by the top sport team. And that means from my side, good night.